Hello and welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. My name is Carl Ozhakovsky and I'll be taking you through the next hour or so. On today's program, we are going to be speaking with Josie Kitson. She is the project manager for Canada's branch of the World Society for the Protection of Animals, WSPA, and she's going to be on the show today to talk to us about the problem of overpopulation of dogs on First Nations reserves across Canada. It's a very complicated issue, obviously for a lot of different reasons, and we're going to be speaking with Josie about the various facets of that issue. But before we do that, as always, I want to bring you guys some news. A couple of announcements quickly. This Thursday, March 18th at Panacea, which is at 588 Bloor Street West, for those of you who are listening from the Toronto area, you know where that is. This is a chocolate party. Apparently this week is National Chocolate Week. Who would have thought? So to celebrate National Chocolate Week, Boardwalk Chocolates, which is run by Sue Moffat of Lickin' the Beaters fame, is going to be having a chocolate party Thursday, March 18th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Panacea, 588 Bloor Street West. She's going to be selling all sorts of new vegan chocolates and also selling her second recipe collection, Lickin' the Beaters 2. So do be there again Thursday, March 18th, 7 to 9 p.m. at Panacea, which is 588 Bloor Street West. And the second announcement today, coming to us from the Faculty of Sociology at Brock, there will be a book launch Friday, March 26th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Niagara Arts Center, 354 St. Paul Street in St. Catharines. The book launch, well, actually, the whole event is called The Ape in the Mirror, and it's a launch for Professor John Sorensen's book, Ape, as well as a fundraiser for the Storybook Farm Primate Sanctuary. There's going to be interactive presentations from both Professor Sorensen and Sherry Delaney, who runs the Storybook Farm Primate Sanctuary, so please be sure to check it out. Again, Friday, March 26th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Niagara Artist Center, 354 St. Paul Street, St. Catharines. And now for a couple pieces of news. The first piece coming to us from the Associated Press. The headline is, Siberian Tigers Die in Chinese Zoo. 11 tigers reportedly starved and caged. 11 rare Siberian tigers have died at a cash-strapped zoo in China, heightening concerns about conditions at wildlife facilities in the country. The tigers were reportedly starving and kept in small cages. The tigers died in the past 3 months at Shengyang Forest Wild Animal Zoo, located in the country's cold northeast region, officials and state media said Friday. Reports said the tigers had been fed nothing but chicken bones and starved to death. A zoo manager said unspecified diseases killed the animals during the harsh winter. Siberian tigers are one of the world's rarest species. There are an estimated 300 left in the wild, of which 50 are in China. About 5,000 are held captive on farms and wildlife parks across China. The deaths underscore the conflicting signals in China's attempts to save its dwindling numbers of tigers. While extensive conservation efforts are underway, animal protection groups say zoos and wildlife parks may be deliberately breeding more animals than they can afford, hoping to sell off the carcasses onto a black market where tiger parts fetch a high price for use in traditional medicines and liquor. We've seen cases where zoos have steeped the bones from their deceased tigers in liquor to sell to visitors, said Hua Ning, project director for the China branch of the International Fund for Animal Welfare. Zoo spokesman Wu Shi, however, insisted the animals died from quote-unquote various diseases that were hard for them to endure because of this year's unusually harsh winter. He said the tigers were kept in cages indoors because of the bitter cold. Wu wouldn't specify what diseases the animals had. A zoo official denied that there were plans to sell animals' body parts. China banned the sale of tiger parts and the use of tiger parts in Chinese medicine in 1993, imposing stiff sentences on offenders, but tiger bone, penis, and pelts are still sold illegally to consumers, some who believe the products increase potency or can cure ailments from convulsions to skin disease. The next piece of news coming to us again from the Canadian press. The headline is, Seal Pups Beached in Ice-Free Gulf. Pups seen on Quebec shores as far north as Newfoundland's northern peninsula. An exceptional lack of sea ice on the Gulf of St. Lawrence this winter has left seal mothers with few places to bear their young or to feed their pups. The conditions have led to numerous sightings of fuzzy, day-old critters wallowing on beaches, where many will die. Some of those seals are being born on Newfoundland's northern peninsula. Quote, we've got lovely weather here and the shoreline is peppered with seals, retired schoolteacher Oswald Gould said Wednesday in Bear Cove, western Newfoundland, near St. Barb. You can see the young ones being born. They are pupping, right in by the seashore. On the Quebec shores of the Gulf, some people have even carted the big-eyed creatures, which weigh between 10 and 20 kilograms, back home where they try to nurse them to health, de la Chenier said Tuesday. But she said that human interaction can add stress to the situation and diseases can be spread to and from the seals. Her organization has received 5 direct reports of young harp or hooded seals marooned on Quebec's North Shore, Île de la Madeleine, and the Gaspé Peninsula. They have also heard many secondhand accounts of sightings along the shoreline. The harp seal pups are known for their big black eyes and fluffy white coats, while the young hooded seals can be identified by their dark blue-gray fur and white bellies. Neither the hood nor the harp seals found off Quebec's shores are listed as at-risk species, but both can be hunted seasonally in the province with a permit. And finally, the last piece of news today coming to us from the Montreal Gazette. The headline is an interesting one. It is, "A Lawyer for Cats and Dogs, a New Breed of Lawyer, and His Cause is to Stamp Out Cruelty to All Animals, Including Fish." Antoine Guchel does not actually talk to the animals. That doesn't mean he can't figuratively walk with them as their lawyer, he says. Guchel is the first to admit that the concept of lawyers for animals strikes most people as frankly bizarre. Quote, "It's to be expected," he said in an interview. "It's part of the game that new ideas aren't taken seriously at first, but in the end they wind up being adopted. It is an idea that was adopted some years ago by his native canton of Zurich in Switzerland, which created the official post of lawyer for animal welfare in criminal matters, and Guchel is currently that lawyer, the only one of his professional breed in the world today. In this capacity, he can initiate and intervene in prosecution under the country's animal abuse laws as public counsel representing the interests of the abused parties, the animals involved. His quote-unquote clients have for the most part been cats and dogs and cattle, but he hasn't shied away from pushing the envelope and courting ridicule in the bargain, as he did by taking on the case of a pike who was dragged for 10 minutes at the end of an angler's line. He lost that case, but says it was a way of making the point that cruelty to an animal is cruelty, period, no matter if the species is uncuddly. Quote, "It took 10 minutes to struggle to reel the fish in before it was killed. I regard that as cruelty. If someone had done that to a puppy or a kitten, it would have been an outrage." Guchel was in Montreal this week for a symposium at the McGill Law Faculty on animal law, a field that has steadily gained at least academic respectability in recent years. It is now taught by the majority of U.S. law schools and a half a dozen of Canada's leading universities. Guchel was equally unbowed by last Sunday's national referendum in his homeland, whereby a 70% majority of his country folk rejected a proposal to have an office similar to his established in all of Switzerland's cantons. Quote, "The result was unfortunate, but nevertheless, the issue is discussed more intensely than ever, not only in Switzerland, but worldwide." Switzerland has been and remains at the forefront of animal welfare legislation. Some would call its animal protection laws the world's most progressive. Others might be inclined to regard them as the world's loopiest. It requires, among other things, for cattle and horses to be regularly exercised outside barns, and that quote-unquote social animals like pigs, goldfish, and canaries can't be kept alone. It prohibits goldfish from being flushed alive down toilets and sets minimum space requirements for gerbils and proper water temperature for pet frogs. Also in town for the McGill Symposium was David Wolfson, an adjunct professor at New York University, who also lectures at Columbia and has written extensively on animal welfare. He said in an interview that the Swiss proposal for animal welfare lawyers on the public payroll was unique in some ways, but not all that radical in others, and may yet catch on elsewhere as the animal welfare movement progresses. Quote, "The animal welfare movement in modern form has been active and successful only for the past 25 years. What was being proposed wasn't a change in existing laws or extending protections that weren't there. They were trying to put a procedure to provide assistance, to have better enforcement of laws that the general public supports. It's hard to imagine anyone opposed to that, though of course some people are." And that, my friends, is the news for today. Again, you are listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. On today's program, we are going to be speaking with Josie Kitson. Josie Kitson is the project manager for the World Society for the Protection of Animals in Canada. And we're going to be speaking today about the issue of dog overpopulation on native reserves. Should be an interesting show with a lot of food for thought, so please do stick around. If you have any questions about this show or any of our other programs, please do drop us a line, animalvoices@gmail.com. And if you'd like to download this show or any of our other past programs, please do check out our website, www.animalvoices.ca. Today we are speaking with Josie Kitson from the World Society for the Protection of Animals, Canada, and she is the project manager. Her role within the companion animal department involves building relationships with governments, communities, and animal welfare organizations working to address dog population management on First Nations land. Josie has a philosophy degree from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, where she focused on political philosophy, Aboriginal and minority rights, and animal ethics. She also studied international development at Humber College, including sustainable development initiatives, disaster relief, and various project planning methodologies. Prior to joining WISPA, Josie oversaw financial projects and developed business partner programs for a busy mortgage lender in the GTA. Josie Kitson, welcome to Animal Voices.
Thank you very much for having me.
Not a problem. We've gotten a little bit of your background with WISPA and what you do there, but I wanted to ask you a question that I ask all of our guests, really, on the show. And the first question that I always ask is how you got interested in animal issues in the first place.
I think I've always been passionate about the issues from the time that I was a child, and I started asking questions about whether or not I thought, or my mom thought, that the cows were okay with being killed so that we could eat them, and she said no. And little things like that, I guess I really questioned throughout my life. Really, it started, I would probably say, in elementary to high school, where I started looking really critically at these issues and how they applied to my life, and became vegetarian and subsequently became vegan. And wanted also to look at how we can apply development issues, when I say development, I mean international development issues, to the animal welfare world, and that's kind of what led me to WISPA.
Now, I was wondering if you could give us a bit of background on what brought you to this campaign in particular.
This, I felt like it really combined everything that I was interested in and also learned about while I was in school, which is, I think, sometimes puts me in a unique position, because many of us finish university and college and wonder, what are we going to do with everything that we've learned?
Exactly.
At least that's how I felt. And I really felt that this role that opened up at WISPA combined all of those things. I've always been interested in social justice, but my biggest passion has been animal protection. But I felt this really close connection to issues that a lot of First Nations communities were experiencing that I learned about, and I just didn't really know how to make it all click. And so when I came across the position at WISPA of combining my interests with my passion, I couldn't say no to it.
When I think of WISPA, I think of fairly large campaigns. I think of things like the anti-seal hunt campaigns throughout the years. I think of things that have maybe more of a global scope. So I'm wondering if you could give us a sense of why WISPA has a particular interest in this issue.
Well, this issue actually feeds into more of a global perspective. We do work around the world on what we call humane and comprehensive dog management. So we've seen a need to assist governments and individual communities to cope with their dog populations in a very humane and sustainable way. And we've been working on this issue in Canada since 1999 in varying capacities over the year. And when I came on, I really saw this as feeding into our larger goal, which is to eliminate the use of inhumane practices to control dog populations around the world.
For some people listening, they may not really have a sense of what... I keep mentioning the word reserves, and I keep talking about the problem of dog overpopulation on reserves. Maybe we can take a step back for a minute. Could you tell us what are reserves, and why do our First Nations find themselves there?
That's going to be a really hard one for me to answer. I can answer from my experience and perspective.
Sure. To be clear, that's all I'm asking you to answer from.
In my experience, First Nations communities live in particular parcels of land that have been designated to their community as having certain degrees of ownership over. So normally I say First Nations communities rather than reserves, and that just sort of alerts people to the fact that we are working with a particular community that is a contained unit of individuals who are living together, much like we live in a community. In most communities, they have some kind of central point of leadership that speaks on behalf of the people, although that is going to be very different depending on which community you're in. But currently in Canada, we use the band council system. So for each individual community, most often they have a group of individuals that have been appointed to speak on their behalf, much like a municipal government. That's at least how I like to think of it.
Now that we kind of have at least a little bit of a sense of how these communities are structured, what is the situation for dogs sort of a general overview of what the situation is for dogs in First Nations communities in Canada?
Of course, it's going to vary from community to community, but what we've found, when I say we, I mean myself, other animal protection organizations, and also First Nations representatives who are looking at this issue. So what we've found is that the problem with the dog population is quite widespread across Canada, and the problem is different from community to community. But speaking generally, there's normally a higher number of dogs than what we might expect, you or I might expect, from living in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
So there's more dogs. Those dogs are allowed to roam around the community. And that, in and of itself, is not the problem. Oftentimes, we find the dogs are very well socialized, especially in comparison to a dog that may have been tied. So these dogs are allowed to socialize with one another, with other members of the community. Where we start to get into problems is when those dogs aren't receiving adequate resources, so whether that's food, water, or shelter. And so they will start to seek out those resources, and that's when we start running into problems.
Okay. Now, reading the media about this, like I'm looking, for example, at an article from Saskatchewan newspaper, which uses the term reserves over and over again. And there's a sense that the problem of dog overpopulation on native reserves, whether you want to call them communities or reserves, is much more significant than it is, say, in other northern communities that are not reserves. My question is
it worse in First Nations communities than it is in another community that lives in very close proximity but isn't predominantly First Nations?
Yeah, and if so, have you found that there are certain other conditions, whether they be economic or cultural, that that contribute to that?
And that's probably a better question for me to answer. Absolutely. Again, from my perspective, the problems that I observe in First Nations communities that I've been in, I can draw really close parallels to some other communities I've been in the developing world. Let's say, for example, I was recently in Costa Rica observing a dog population, a community there. I can draw the parallels. It's not exactly the same. It's always going to be different, different situation, different climate, different culture. But the problems are very similar, that there is a large number of dogs without a management system in place. The management system that is most often employed is very reactive, and it's often inhumane. That's sort of the closest parallel that I can draw. Now, in terms of whether an exactly parallel community with a lower First Nations population would have a similar problem, I wouldn't be able to speak to that, but I am aware that there are problems in remote communities all across Canada, whether they be First Nations or not.
Okay. Now, when you say reactive programs or a sort of reactive policy towards dog overpopulation, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think a perfect example is the situation in Saskatchewan that's happened recently, in that a child was mauled and killed by a pack of dogs that were roaming through the community, and the solution to address that problem happened after the mauling had already occurred. And to be honest with you, I should step back, because that community did not necessarily take on a very reactive. They decided to sit down. From what I know from the media reports, they did decide to sit down and decide what was the best way to address this. But often what you see is that something bad will happen, and then there's a very, very hard and fast reaction.
Right.
And it's often to just simply eliminate the problem, which people see as solely just the dogs. And if you define the problem as just the dogs, then it seems to make sense to just get rid of them.
Right.
Unfortunately, it's much more complicated than that.
So what do you see as other contributing factors to the problem? If the problem is not just dogs, maybe you could tell us a little bit about WISPA's strategy in addressing an issue like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really see it as a community problem. Dogs are part of the community. They live with us. And the vast majority of people do want dogs in their community. And you can kind of see that because when these culls happen, when dogs are removed from the community, they always find their way back in. So these reactive solutions often have to be applied over and over and over again, And I think that really tells us that people do want dogs in the community. They are going to continue to have them as companions or as working animals for protection or for hunting. So the dogs are going to continue to make their way back into the community. So what we advocate for largely is responsible pet ownership. It's also referred to as responsible animal guardianship, which I actually prefer the term, because I think pet is kind of very, I don't know, southern, very, you know, developed world. How we think of pets as living in our houses and sleeping in our beds, not necessarily the same thing. So we do like to promote responsible pet ownership or responsible animal guardianship. So that's sort of, I see that as a very individual thing. People are responsible in particular ways for their animals. And then to take it up one level, we'd also like to see governments being more proactive and prioritizing the issue of the dogs rather than waiting for something really bad to happen, mm-hmm. maybe examining the issue and seeing how it connects to other issues in the community and what systems are already in place to help them address the problems that are coming up because of the dog population.
We need to take a very short break, but I wanted to just ask you to expand on something you touched on in your last response. You mentioned some of the different roles that the dogs play for First Nations communities. I was wondering if you could just expand a little bit, because, as you said, this idea that they're pets is not really accurate to a large degree. Of course, they play a companionship role, for sure, but their role in those communities goes far beyond that. Maybe you could expand a little bit on that.
I can only speak from the communities that I've been in, mm-hmm. But I've seen very, very mixed purposes or uses for dogs. A community that I've been to in Alberta on several occasions to assist one of our member societies with an on-site veterinary services clinic, we see everything. We see tiny little dogs who live in people's houses, who are very much what we think of, at least what I think of when I hear the word pet, think of. But then there's larger dogs who live mostly outside, who roam through the community. Those dogs could be used as guards. They could be used for hunting. But they don't necessarily live inside the house. And then, of course, just like in any community around the world, anywhere, we see also dogs who are predominantly living outside, who may be tied up, who aren't being cared for, who aren't receiving all the resources that they need. So you can see like a very, very wide spectrum depending on which community you're in. And it's going to be very different for communities in the far north as well. I have not visited the far north, but from what I understand from colleagues, it's the dogs very much are working dogs in a lot of Inuit communities. Are used for hunting, and they're used to pull dog sleds still. So dogs have very, very varying degrees of roles in depending on the community.
I wanted to ask you, Josie, I know that you're acting as a spokesperson right now for WSPA, but I was wondering if you could give us maybe a little bit of a personal take on why you think we only hear about an issue such as dog overpopulation in First Nations communities when a child is mauled. For example, it seems like one of those animal issues that only reaches the press when there is a tragedy like that happens.
Well, I guess for me personally, it'd be two reasons. One, oftentimes the media only reports on things that are negative or can be sensationalized. And I think a really good example of that was what happened in Saskatchewan. And there was articles about packs of feral dogs terrorizing communities. And It's really blown out of proportion. The dogs are not feral. These dogs are owned. Someone owns these dogs. And then you would start to see media reports sort of countering that, especially when they actually went to the source and went to the First Nations community to actually ask the people what they thought about it. You know, they would get community members saying, no, these dogs are not feral. People own them. We know who owns them. It's just sort of a lack of supervision of those dogs. So, I mean, I think that's one side. It's sort of that sensational story that everyone gets really excited about. And I think the other side of it is that it's a really complicated issue that I don't know that anyone really has a full grasp of exactly what's happening and why it's happening and what we can do to help alleviate some of the problems that are occurring in First Nations communities. So it's a problem that's really flown under the radar for a very long time. And I think it's because it is very complicated and also because it has to compete against a lot of other social issues that are occurring. So it's not always getting the full priority that it deserves.
I imagine that an organization like WSPA faces at least somewhat of a degree of criticism for doing work like this, in the sense that it could be seen as an imposition of a particular viewpoint on a group of people who has, in the past several hundred years, had Western viewpoints already imposed upon them. And I'm wondering if you could maybe respond to a bit of a devil's advocate question. Do you think WISPA is imposing a Western viewpoint about animal management on First Nations communities? And if so, how would you respond to that?
Well, I think I've actually been really lucky at WISPA that I've been able to apply some of the development methods that I've learned to this project. So when I came on to work with WISPA, in the past we had mostly done training for animal control officers and run veterinary clinics, so whether it's sterilization or just general animal treatment in individual communities. So I was very lucky when I came on that WISPA was very interested in sort of examining this project and determining where we could go with it. And I was very determined right from the beginning that it would not be an outside message coming into the communities. Mm-hmm. And what I think we've been really successful in doing is engaging with First Nations representatives to work with them to determine what is the best approach to sort of moving forward on this issue. I don't want to say solving the problem,
right,
but sort of how can we move together in partnership to help overcome some of the problems associated with dogs. And there's really amazing, amazing organizations out there like the Assembly of First Nations that works very, very closely with not just the First Nations communities that they represent all across Canada, but also with partner organizations, so lots of other government and non-government organizations, to sort of draw from experiences and figure out how those experiences can help shape and inform their policies for First Nations communities.
Now, you mentioned working with leadership of communities. Could you maybe paint a picture for us of what that process looks like? Like, does WISPA identify communities that they believe to have an overpopulation problem? Is WISPA approached by communities to come in and help them with this kind of work? How does that partnership begin, and how do decisions get made within that?
Well, in the past, we've been approached by communities. We started doing work, I believe, from 2002 to 2006 in the James Bay region of Quebec with individual Cree communities. We were approached by those communities for assistance. But the project has moved beyond on-the-ground work. So what now we are actually doing is, what we've tried to do is look at this problem from a national perspective. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of individual communities out there who are reaching out for and asking for assistance, and we have many partners who are working on the ground to assist those communities. But what we've done here at WISPA is sort of said, well, where can we have the greatest impact? And we thought trying to look at this from a national perspective would be the best way. So we're engaging with national groups like the Assembly of First Nations and provincial political bodies like, for example, the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, because they actually have contact with a very wide number of individuals, and also they also have contact with leadership in individual communities as well. So we're working with these organizations to help them to look at the issues and examine the issues and determine what's going to work for First Nations. Now, we also have partner organizations that we work with, and that's a very different approach. They would be working directly with individual communities, and oftentimes they are approached by a community for assistance. And so the process of going through the needs of the community in those situations can be very different.
One of the things that I continually came across in doing research to do this show was the question of jurisdiction, a common theme in newspaper articles discussing child maulings by packs of dogs and that sort of thing. One of the things that is mentioned repeatedly is that perhaps local humane societies should be intervening, coming onto these communities, and basically taking those animal control or animal welfare matters into their own hands. Then there's also the other perspective that says, well, no, these First Nations communities within the reserve system, they are allowed a a particular amount of control over their day-to-day affairs, and they should make those decisions, and they should manage it themselves. So I imagine that WISPA sort of represents kind of a bridge between those two perspectives to some degree, but I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on the subject of jurisdiction and how that plays into this issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, for me personally, I do think it's very, very important that individual communities take responsibility over the issue and prioritize it as an issue. And it's going to be up to those individual communities to determine what is going to work best for them. Of course, we advocate for any response to the dog population to be humane and to be comprehensive. But there are a lot of cases across Canada of First Nations communities identifying they have a problem, determining what they're going to use as a solution, but then also going outside and asking for assistance from other animal protection organizations to help them to reach that goal of having a healthy, manageable dog population that coexists with the community and, you know, isn't causing other health and safety problems for humans as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I really do see it as a bridge. I think that's actually a really great way to describe it.
We've talked a little bit about humane alternatives to different solutions, and one of the things that I came across in my research was, and maybe you could tell me whether this is sort of a media manipulation or not, this idea that things like dog shoot days are a common occurrence in First Nations communities, where, you know, the solution to dog overpopulation is simply rounding up a particular number of dogs that are part of the overpopulation problem and shooting them. If that is the case, and if that is a sort of common way of dealing with the problem, I imagine humane education has quite a long way to go in terms of bridging that gap. But I'm also sort of hesitant to believe that these, as they've called them in various papers, dog shoot days are as common occurrence as they say.
Well, I have bad news. Based on my research, dog shoot days are the most common way of managing the population. Mm. I do not know how widespread it is. I have heard of it happening in various communities all across Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And when speaking to colleagues, whether they represent animal protection or First Nations communities, it does seem to be the most common method for managing the dog population, if there is a method being employed. Now, there are communities across Canada who are using humane methods, who are looking at the problem comprehensively and, you know, putting together solutions that are long-term and that are humane, but there are other communities that don't have a means to use those solutions,
mm-hmm.
or maybe are, if it's possible, not even aware that those solutions exist. So dog shoot days are used. It is common. And, of course, we do not advocate for the use of dog shoot days. It's definitely not a humane solution, and it's definitely not long-term. And I think a good example of that is the need for it to be continuously used,
right,
over and over and over again. And it sort of speaks to what I was mentioning earlier, is that removing the dogs is not really an option, because dogs will find their way back into the community, and they were there for a purpose to begin with. People want to have dogs around. They play an important role in our lives and in our communities, so simply getting rid of them is not really an option.
So I imagine then if the common method being used to control dog overpopulation is something like rounding up and shooting them, I imagine that going from that to a more humane perspective, which includes things like spay and neuter programs, is not only a matter of, you know, having the proper resources in place to do spay and neuter, but also a fairly significant mind shift.
Well, I've not yet met a community that thinks the dog shoot days are great and that they can't wait for the next one to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It seems, from my perspective, that it's employed more because the communities don't really see any other option, because the dogs are getting to the point where they're becoming a nuisance or threatening the human population. And the most short-term, efficient, and oftentimes cost-effective way to address the problem is to shoot the dogs and to remove them from the community, which is really, is very sad, not only from my perspective, you know, as someone who advocates for humane ways of managing the population, but also for the community. you can probably imagine what it's like to know that something like that is coming around the corner the next day. And, mm-hmm. you know, maybe the dog that you've been feeding in your backyard is likely going to be involved in a dog shoot day. So there is a lot of distress around dog shoot days. But again, the solutions have not been really forthcoming. And the solutions are not really, at this point right now, cost effective. So when we talk about our preferred method for managing the dog population, it's a combination of public education, access to veterinary services, legislation, for example, bylaws, and enforcement of those bylaws. And so you can already look at a couple of those methods that are costly. Veterinary services and enforcement of bylaws are costly. So there is not an easy, fast solution to this problem.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's clear to everyone that dog shoot days are not the preferred method and that they don't work. So I think it's time for us to start looking for creative ways to solve the problem.
Now, I imagine that an organization such as WISPA or any organization that would be interested in sort of approaching this issue, you know, it brings to mind other international development issues where animals tend to come last in the priority of problems that need to be dealt with. And the problems that occur in First Nations communities are numerous. And talking about a system where many First Nations communities don't have clean drinking water, for example, you know, we're essentially dealing with a quote-unquote third world within the first world. Do you see campaigns to bring more spay and neuter programs into place? Do you see those as actually being a priority within these communities, or do you think that it's kind of an uphill battle to put these things into place, given all of the other problems that these communities face?
Well, I think, first of all, it's really important for us to recognize that spay and neuter is only one side of the solution.
Right.
So having a sterilization clinic where you're spaying and neutering dogs is really important part of a potential solution. But I have seen communities where sterilization clinics have been implemented and then dog shoot days have occurred several months later.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's very important for WISPA that a solution be very holistic, that it sort of touch on all areas, legislation, education, and other veterinary treatments besides spay and neuter. So I think that's kind of what makes the problem a little bit more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of your question, it is currently low on the list of priorities, and I can understand why. And that's usually the resistance that I see if I'm speaking to representatives about this issue. You have to recognize that there's a lot of issues in the community, and I completely agree, but I do see a connection with all of the issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I also see that there is a connection to human health and safety with this issue. And when you take the issue and you reframe it as a health and safety issue, a lot more people see the significance of it for their individual communities. So
mm-hmm.
I'd love to be able to walk into a room and simply use the argument that animal welfare is something that is extremely important and it needs to be protected, but oftentimes, you're right, those things do fall to the lower levels of the priority list. But what I've been working to do is sort of reframe it as a human health and safety issue, and I think it does help leadership especially to sort of see, yes, these issues do impact our communities, and they're aware that they're impacting the communities, but how and in what ways, that information really seems to be drawn out when you make the human health and safety connection.
And so how do you make that connection? If you were doing this, let's say, cold, how would you explain to someone that this is a human health and safety issue?
Well, I think the best way to start out is to start by asking questions of the community, of the leadership, or whoever you're speaking to, and say, what are the problems associated with dogs in the community? And most importantly, how does the community feel about the dog population? And oftentimes you'll start getting responses like, you know, I tried to go for a run the other day and I had to carry rocks in my hands to throw at the dogs.
Wow.
Or, you know, my kids can't walk home from school by themselves because the dogs follow them.
Mm.
And they're worried that something bad is going to happen. So in some communities, there is a general fear of the dogs. Fear of something bad happening to children or elders, whether it be dog bites or maulings. There are some instances of diseases being transmitted. I mean, rabies is not something that is a massive threat in Canada, but the threat does exist, and the fact that dogs in First Nations communities are a lot of times unsupervised and left to roam means they can come in contact with animals that traditionally carry rabies like bats and raccoons. So that disease, that threat is very real. And also, you know, there are certain parasites that are very, very easily treated in animals, but if they're not, they can be passed on to humans. So
I'm wondering if you can give our listeners a sense of how they might be able to get involved or help WISPA do their work in helping out with this issue.
Well, most of our work, like I mentioned, is sort of at the national and provincial leadership level, but there are some absolutely amazing animal protection organizations all across Canada that are working on this issue. We are able, you know, we're lucky enough to support some of those organizations that are working in Alberta and BC, but almost every province has an organization that's working collaboratively with local First Nations communities to help them address the dog problems in different ways. So we do have some information up on our website, but if you are interested in getting involved, there are organizations province by province. I don't know of a collective list of them, but if someone's really keen to get involved, then I'd be happy to sort of field any questions and point them in the right direction.
Sure, and maybe you could give people WISPA's website.
Yeah, the website is www.wspa.ca.
Excellent. Josie, thank you so much for being on the program. It's been a really informative conversation, and I appreciate the care with which you've answered a lot of these really complex and at times very difficult and loaded questions, especially in this, you know, we're speaking in a Canadian context with hundreds of years at this point of very fraught relations with First Nations in Canada, and I can only imagine that this issue is a tremendously difficult one to tackle right. So I do appreciate you being on the show and fielding my maybe at times loaded questions, and best of luck with all of the work in this program, and we'll be keeping tabs on it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Not a problem. Take care.
You too.
We were just speaking with Josie Kitson, Project Manager for the World Society for the Protection of Animals Canada, and this was Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please do drop us an email, animalvoices@gmail.com. Do check out our website, www.animalvoices.ca. That is the end of the program. Coming up next will be Dos Mundos.